seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory.
Dr. Martin Luther King speaking April 3, 1968. Within 24 hours, he would be dead, assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, April 4, 1968. Today is the federal holiday that honors him. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Terracena. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Godarz, and Karl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the magical music petting zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany, and KBOO.fm via the World Wide Web. I am Cecil Prescott on KBOO Portland. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I'm joined here this morning with Tammy Hapateas, the Public Affairs Director here at KBOO, and we're here with a very special program this morning. We're speaking with Marvin Pena.
That's good.
And he, Marvin is with the VOS, and particularly with the MLK Workers Center there. And thank you so much for joining us this day.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me, and a great opportunity to spread the word about the work we're doing now.
So tell us a little bit about you, and then tell us a little bit about the work you're doing at the MLK Center.
Let's try to make it short. Yeah. I've been with the organization for a year and a half now, and the way it ended up working with VOS, basically it's like a little bit of the story of some of these workers. I was going to school, but also doing a lot of side jobs and trying to make ends meet. But of course, like for so many limitations like immigration status, so I needed to do certain jobs, and I was limited to do just a few things. And I did that for probably 4 years or so while I was going to school. And once I finished and I, you know, kind of fixed all the paperwork that I need to fix to be able to work in the U.S., I was able to find a job and looking for a job, and I found this one through a friend of mine who I used to work with. And I saw the mission, and I experienced some of these same barriers and limitations, and I saw myself like reflected in some of these workers to some extent, and I figured, well, there is a way that I can help and support with my skills. I definitely will do that. So that's how I came to work at Voss, and this time there, I've seen the need of how we can improve their life in some way and support them in their efforts to, you know, thrive in their own way. That's something that I like to emphasize. It's more like we're supporting their dreams and their hopes. We're not there to tell them what to do. It's just giving them tools to for them to figure out how they want to do things.
And is that the part about the mission that really spoke to you the most? Or
yeah, because I felt that while I was working that most of the time, some people, and I know it comes from a good place and good intentions, wants to help you, but like that savior complex kind of thing. And I felt that like, no, I just need the opportunity. I don't need you to tell me what to do or how I should do things. Just give me the chance that I don't have for whatever reason, either language barrier, immigration status, whatever. I just need the opportunity. So the idea with Voss is trying to work with the community to create those spaces for the workers to be able to thrive instead of just being told what to do. And because if no one knows their needs, they know better than I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, someone once said to me, everyone is a master of their own experience.
Definitely.
And that's, yeah, definitely. That's definitely rings true. So you've been doing this for a year and a half, and yes. What was, I guess, what was the initial, I guess, response, like, to you personally? Because I'm sure it's hard, you know, you see people in your own, that, you know,
it
you
is,
see yourself yeah. in them and all.
It is. When I came to the worker center for the first time and I saw you know, the many barriers from homelessness to mental issues to language barriers, mm-hmm. that's a big deal. So, and I see that we as an organization, we're trying to do our best to, you know, provide resources in some way, and but with a lot of limitations from budget limitations and space, and we don't have like an adequate facility to give trainings or to give classes. And so I saw so many barriers, and it was, well, this is hard. It's hard to help people or support them if we don't have the the right tools. Mm-hmm. And so my initial reaction was like, I know how it feels, but I also want to do something to improve these conditions of the organization as a whole. And I was talking a little bit ago about how I've been the last year going to colleges and to government agencies, to everywhere, talking to people about the work we do, because that's the other thing. We want the community to be aware of the work we do, but also support. I want that Voss has more community support mm-hmm. than anything else. And for that, there is a lot of legwork to do, and being out there is like definitely like a campaign, mm-hmm. definitely. And it's an ongoing thing that cannot stop. It needs to be there and reminding people constantly why it's important to support an organization like Voss, and the reason behind it, the inclusion, the just open spaces for everyone. And we all have different skills. It's just we don't have the chances that that other people have. So that's kind of where we are right now. Keep doing that work.
You're listening to KBOO. We're speaking this day with Marvin Pena, who has served for the last year and a half as the Grassroots Engagement Coordinator at Voss MLK Workers Center. Now, tell us a little bit about where Voss is and the MLK Workers Center.
Yes. The Worker Center is it's actually really close by. It's on Grand and MLK and Everett, sorry. And that corner, and it has been around there for about two decades now. Mm. Workers used to gather around those corners. And the way work was, you know, came about to be, it was like these workers were there, and they still are victim of, you know, police harassment, mm-hmm. or immigration harassment, or wage theft, mistreatment. Like, there are so many issues that they face, and they decided to organize as a group. And that's how first they came together as a group and tried to, you know, defend themselves of all these issues. And almost 20 years ago, they gathered and they decided to organize as a group. And then in around 2000, with the St. Francis Church, we were formed as an organization. And then we became a nonprofit a little bit after that. The work that we're doing there right now is, with the resources that we have, is supporting with workshops like Know Your Rights, mm-hmm. which is really important. Mm-hmm. Also, Know Your Rights, not just immigration-wise, but also like labor rights. Mm-hmm. Yes. How to realize that you've been abused, or you're working hours that you shouldn't be working, that you have the right to have breaks, and so many little things that, because of the needs, they don't pay attention to, and or they don't even know. And that's what we're trying to provide with these resources, like, hey, you have rights to, for this, and you should definitely stand up to that, and we will be behind you. That's the other thing. Like, when to give you an example, sometimes workers go out and do some kind of work, and then they have some kind of issues with the employer, and so language barrier always is a big deal. So they can call us, and then we kind of advocate for the worker, or try to advocate the best we can. So we provide support, not just having the place for them, but also afterwards, and kind of follow up. We have things like the wage theft, mm-hmm. and we have volunteers who goes and take intake from the workers when they haven't been paid for whatever reason, and then we try to follow up with that. And I mean, we cannot do much legally, but also we have a partnership with the Oregon Law Center that goes once a month to check on this case and see how they can help in some way, or refer them to different organizations, because we don't have the capacity, but we see the issue every day, and more often than you will think. So, and all those different things, we have safety classes, we have orientations, work ethic, and all those kind of things that help to improve their job conditions in many ways. So, yeah.
You work at a place called MLK Workers Center. Tell us about why that name was chosen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To be honest, I think it was because based on the Martin Luther King like dream, as he said in his speech, the idea is that we all are created equals, and we all have the rights to, you know, to be free and to do whatever we feel like our dreams are. And so that, I think that was that was a while ago, but mm-hmm. I think it was based on that, like, that idea of that we all are created equal and we all have the rights to thrive in our own way. And it aligns a lot with the mission of, regardless of your color, skin, or your background, we are part of a community, and we deserve at least a chance to be part of the community and thrive in our own way. So I will think that will be the core of the message here, is just we all have the right to, regardless of our religion, background, color, skin, or anything else.
And one thing that we know is that Martin King was assassinated while working with sanitation workers who mm-hmm. In Memphis were at the bottom of the bottom. Mm-hmm. And throughout his career, he talked about workers' rights, mm-hmm. and even spoke early on against right-to-work states and laws like that. So sure. this is all, as you mentioned, part of this understanding of what the dream is in terms of who we are.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that last year we did a little bit of work and advocacy work in terms of supporting other organizations to pass laws that benefit workers. Like we didn't lead that, but we were part of the driver license campaign, and also we went to Salem a couple of times to support a law that requires employers who violate some worker rights to pay back some kind of fee. That's still in the process, but we have been part of this kind of movement where we want to make sure that laws are in place to protect workers and their well-being. And this year, hopefully, we had a advocacy coordinator, so we're going to be more involved even in more advocacy work, to not just city level, but state level. And the idea is to lead movements, not so much like, you know, supporting other ones, but also lead our own movement, because we work with a really particular sector of the community, and we are the only organization in Oregon that works with day laborers, mm-hmm. at least at this segment. And the closest one is in Seattle. It's called Casa Latina, and they do the same work we do. But in Oregon, we are the only one who work with this community.
I think it's so important to highlight that it's also support for workers, but it's also implementing policy, which is the most important. Mm. And, you know, in America, the only way to really have change that's going to stay and stake for the long run.
Yeah.
So you mentioned some of the stuff that you are supporting, and, you know, the longevity of the scope of the VO. So why do you think that VAS is the only organization that supports this specific demographic?
Yeah, I think there are so many variables that plays into the day labor community. Most of them, I will say 85%, probably more, are immigrant workers. And so there are a few things that I think is important to understand. Like first, it's just understanding that being an immigrant in the U.S. is an experience by itself, and then mm-hmm. trying to work in the United States under these conditions and all the limitations. So there are so many variables that plays into the work we do. Like, then you have the labor rights, then you have the immigration situation, then we have language barriers. So mm-hmm. we need ESL classes too, or we actually have some. Mm-hmm. So there are so many variables that I think is really unique, the work we do, and not many organizations, they are more dedicated to one of those variables, like mental health or housing. Or so we manage kind of a little bit of everything, and fortunately we don't have the capacity to solve all the issues, but understanding that allowed us to see how we can help best. And the good thing also is, like, our organization, most of the leadership are immigrants or people of color, so it's important to understand that too, because it's a whole different experience when you have that background and you can relate a lot with the work you do. So I think it's that's why it's so unique, and we deal with so many variables, and that's why we existed, and why how we came about to be, kind of thing. So
you mentioned about, you know, the many barriers you yeah. face, and tell us something about, in terms of how you maintain a sense of community with the people from the various communities, various concerns yeah. you mentioned, you know, various challenges. Sure. Why is it important to build a community?
Sure. I think one of the main, barriers, issues that I see is that some of the people, they don't understand that these workers are like human beings like you and me, with hopes and dreams. And I believe there is a disconnection between, like, you know, that human element, just like they are not just workers and you hire them. So it's a whole dynamic. And we try to make sure that employers who hire through us, they understand that. And mm-hmm. they see it's still an ongoing process, and it will be. But our goal is that they see that, you know, you're not just hiring like a guy or a girl to do whatever. It's just like you're providing some kind of income for them to just survive, or if they have family, some of them. So it's creating that connection and like, yeah, they are human beings like you and me, and they have hopes and dreams like you do, because then you see the work we're doing with a whole different lens. Like, you see that this is another group of people that need some support, and then creating spaces for them. So trying to portray that in some way, but it's a challenge because some of them, they don't want to be seen for obvious reasons, like especially in this political climate, like they don't want to be seen as an immigrant for many reasons. So it's hard to show that human element to the community because, of course, most of them are afraid of being, you know, portrayed out there in whatever media. So it's a really hard, you know, it's a challenge definitely to connect that. But going to your question, it's important that people understand that it's not just a worker, it's someone else that have hopes and dreams like you. And connecting with the human element and aspect of it with the community is, in my opinion, is how you, you know, make people care about the work we do, basically. Yeah,
I think it's important to make people aware. And as you mentioned, in terms of the human element, earlier on, you mentioned some of the challenges they've faced. And one thing you mentioned is in terms of wage theft. And especially with communities who are seen as most vulnerable, the challenge they face, what do you do? I mean, when you work and you aren't given the wages that you deserve, I mean, who do you turn to? I mean, do you want to make trouble or have the light shine upon you? And I suppose that by working as a community, that's a way in which you give voice to many people. And so someone doesn't have to stand alone and feel abandoned.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Like, being part of VOS and being a member of the organization give you that sense of community and support, that someone is behind you and you're not out there doing it by yourself, risking, I mean, so many things. And that's something that with the Wage Theft and Justice Clinic we have, is having at least the little resources that we can provide to workers. That way they don't feel like they are, you know, facing all this by themselves because of, you know, many navigating the system. Or, and I mean, it's so complicated for anyone, to be honest, and especially if you don't, you know, speak the language or things like that. So, yeah, it's really important that, that the community knows that being part of VOS is having a support and someone having your back, but as a community, not just you standing alone there and trying to face everything by yourself.
And speaking of community, if listeners want to show support or learn more about the organization, is there a website, social media?
You can find us on Instagram and Facebook as VOS Portland, and we should show up there the first result, but also www.portlandvoz.org. You can see we have our history and how we when we were founded, but also ways to get involved as a volunteer. Just of course donations, as everyone knows, nonprofit always struggle with budgets, and there is a donation page, and you can become a regular donor. I mean, honestly, whatever, $5 to $10, everything helps, to be honest. And you can go again, www.portlandvoz.org, and you can, you know, just sign up. And also we have our newsletter with events that we do. And so it's a whole lot of information there.
That's awesome. Yeah. I have, no, we don't have too much time left, but I want to ask you, just in the spirit of MLK Day and all that, if you could tell us one success story, or I'm sure you have plenty, but like one that really stuck with you.
Well, actually, not long ago, we had one of the workers who had a visual disability, and he, with our support, managed to navigate, and he was basically homeless, and then he was living in shelters, And we were talking a while ago, and he said like how, and he was also alcoholic, so he went through a whole process. I mean, honestly, because of his own effort, but also be support in some way, mm-hmm. And having a place for him to come. But then he was telling me how he was living now with like a roommate. So I can see how even a little bit of help and support can go a long way, and how he in particular like went from this situation now having some stability and some mm-hmm. kind of housing and improve his life. And that right there, I thought like this is a good example, like even with a little bit we can make a difference. And that's what I always encourage people from the community, not just the native, but just to see what we do and support what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that you know, as we come to the conclusion of sure. our opportunity to have this discussion with you, and as you mentioned in terms of that example of things of success yeah. and things that that's inspiring, if you were all powerful and you could have the ability to transform people perceptions of day laborers,
yeah.
what do you want people to know?
All powerful. I think I wish that people see that they can make a huge difference in someone's life just hiring them. Like a lot of them, they have a lot of skills, and but because so many, you know, misconceptions and unfounded fears and you name it, I wish that people see that, yeah, there are some challenges, but hiring people and giving them the chance, to be honest, not saving them. It's just they need a chance, and we all need an opportunity no matter what. So having them give them that space and creating spaces for them to thrive, I wish that I can put that in everyone's, you know, front of
yeah.
line, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Oh. Well, I, you know, my mother is an immigrant, and she was exploited for most of her life as an immigrant, and, you know, just being a woman of color and yeah. all. And it wasn't until she became part of a union when she actually started seeing some significant changes in her life.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, is the legality of the demographics you work with created a challenge from Voss being a full-on union, and is that why it went the nonprofit route, or what's the difference between the work that you do in a union?
In our case, because of the you mentioned it, like the legality of being a nonprofit, and also we're not, and I want to make that differentiation, like we're not like a temp agency, mm-hmm. a labor ready kind of thing. We are more like an education organization that mm-hmm. provide resources to workers. They decide if they want to work, and they decide how much they want to charge. We don't tell them what to do. We are just there to provide resources and educational for the most part, and at the same time having a place for them to go. So in that regard, we cannot like promote any kind of unionize for mm-hmm. like for them to get union. But we definitely support workers' rights in that way, and unions and community coming together to defend their rights.
Mm-hmm.
But as a nonprofit, as an organization, we provide more educational resources and different other resources, and they decided what to do. But going to your comment, like we show that why is that important, and being unionized and being part of a bigger community is important when it comes to defend your rights and support the work you do. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The support can go such a long way, you know, just yeah. so long, because, you know, it's not just the people, it's not just workers. They also have kids. They also have families. They yeah. also have,
behind
you know,
that, yeah.
yeah, so many people that it's an intertwined, yeah, you know, thing. So
definitely.
Community support, it goes a very, very long way.
Yeah.
So we really appreciate you, Marvin, for taking the time this morning yeah. and for on this Martin Luther King to come from the MLK Workers Center yeah. To help us to remember these things about how important these issues are, especially on a day like this. Martin King said shortly before he died, We look around every day and we see thousands and millions of people making inadequate wages. Not only do they work in our hospitals, they work in our hotels, they work in our laundries, they work in domestic service, they find themselves underemployed. You see, no labor is really menial labor unless you're not getting adequate wages. Mm-hmm. People are always talking about menial labor, but if you're not getting a good wage, as I know that through some unions that brought it up, that isn't menial labor. What is menial is not the is the income, the wages.
Yeah.
The people aren't menial, mm-hmm. it's the wages they earn. And the MLK Workers Center and the great work that Vos is doing is a reminder of that we continue to work for this beloved community.
Definitely. I like that. And kind of going with the comment, it's like there's no unskilled labor. Like it's just labor and different kind of labor. So you need some kind of skill regardless. So kind of going with that. So thank you.
And you're going to be here tomorrow also for Hindsight 2020 to talk more about the labor aspect of it. So for the listeners, I know this is cut short, but we will be talking about it again tomorrow, 1:30. And thank you so much for tuning in to our special MLK programming. We're going to keep going with some great stuff. Really a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much again.
Thank you for having me.
And what's that website one last time?
Yes, www.portlandvoz.org.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Contact.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
It's one of the most famous speeches of all time, and it nearly didn't happen.
Wyatt T. Walker says to King, don't do the I Have a Dream thing. It's trite, it's a cliche, you've used it too many times before.
But on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. ignored that advice. In front of what was then the largest civil rights demonstration the Capitol had ever seen, he did the I Have a Dream thing.
Black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
On this edition of Making Contact, Gary Young talks about his book, The Speech, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream, and the story behind it.
The book is called The Speech, and it's about King's famous speech at the March on Washington. And if left there as an idea, then you have a great man and a great talk. But King could not do that on its own. The speech and the march came from somewhere. I want to start by giving some context to that text, because in the absence of that, there would have been no march and there would have been no speech.
Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution. Because I see the face of things to come. Yes, I do.
And so I start with some of the people whose names perhaps we don't know, but who paid for that speech in a range of ways. I begin with Franklin McCain, who was a 17-year-old in Greensboro, North Carolina, who made his stand by taking his seat at the Woolworths downtown on February the 1st, 1960. When I interviewed Franklin McCain, he said that up until that time, as a young man in North Carolina, he felt that his life was worthless and that his parents had lied to him. And the lie that they told him was a great American lie that you can be anything you want to be. And he said, as he grew through adolescence, he knew that wasn't true. As a 17-year-old black male in North Carolina, he knew that that wasn't true. And just as a symbol of how untrue that was, a completely different story that I was doing, several years later, I interviewed a guy called Buford Posey from Mississippi, a white guy who became an anti-racist, who told me, quite kind of matter of fact, he said, I never knew that it was illegal to kill a black man until I joined the army. He said, until that time, I knew it was wrong, but I didn't know it was illegal. And true enough, in Mississippi, the people who were as likely as not to be killing black people were actually the law enforcement agencies. So it was not an entirely incredible thing for him to think. So if we go back to Franklin McCain, he knows this as well as Buford Posey does. And he says he was angry at his parents for this lie. And so they sat up, him and his friends, late into the night, January 31st, talking about how everybody had failed them before they talked themselves into the action that they took the following day, not knowing when they showed up at Woolworths in Greensboro whether any of the others would be there. He says, we wanted to go beyond what our parents had done, and the worst thing that could happen was that the Klan could kill us. But I had no concern for my personal safety. The day I sat at that counter, I had the most tremendous feeling of elation and celebration. I felt that in this life, nothing else mattered. If there's a heaven, I got there for a few minutes. I just felt you can't touch me. You can't hurt me. There's no other experience like it, not even the birth of my first child. A few years later, in May 63, in Birmingham, Alabama, a burly white police officer attempted to intimidate some black school children to keep them from joining the growing anti-segregation protests. They assured him they knew what they were doing, ignored his entreaties, and continued their march toward Kelly Ingram Park, where they were arrested. A reporter asked one of them her age. 6, she said, as she climbed into the paddy wagon. The following month in Mississippi, stalwart civil rights campaigner Fannie Lou Hamer overheard Annell Ponder, a fellow activist, being beaten in jail in an adjacent cell. Can you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir, the policeman demanded. Yes, I can, replied Ponder. So say it. I don't know you well enough, said Ponder. And then Hamer heard her head hit the floor again. The Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuscinski once wrote, all books about all revolutions begin with a chapter that describes the decay of tottering authority or the misery and sufferings of the people. But they should begin with a psychological chapter, one that shows how a harassed, terrified man suddenly breaks his terror and stops being afraid. This unusual process demands illuminating. Man gets rid of fear and feels free. The period preceding King's speech at the March on Washington was one such chapter. Until that point, there had, of course, been many fearless acts by anti-racist protesters. But in that moment, the number who were prepared to commit them reached a critical mass. In May 63, the New York Times published more stories about civil rights in 2 weeks than it had in the previous 2 years. During the 10-week period following Kennedy's address on civil rights in June that year, there were 758 demonstrations in 186 cities, resulting in 14,733 arrests. Such were the conditions that made the March on Washington possible and King's speech so resonant. And this context was global. 2 days after McCain made his protest in Greensboro, the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan addressed the South African Parliament in Cape Town with an ominous warning.
The wind of change is blowing through this continent. And whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact.
Some, including his immediate audience and apartheid parliament, didn't like it at all. But as a decade wore on, that wind became a gale. In the 3 years between Macmillan's speech and the March on Washington, the following countries became independent. Togo, Mali, Senegal, Zaire, Somalia, Benin, Niger, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Chad, Central African Republic, Congo, Gabon, Nigeria, Mauritania, Sierra Leone, Tanganyika, and Jamaica. Internationally, non-racial democracy and the black enfranchisement that came with it were the order of the day. The longer America practiced legal segregation, the more it looked like a slum on the wrong side of history than a shining city on the hill. Now, the story of that year in particular is the story of the base, the masses, the grassroots continually running ahead of the leadership. King spoke in Harlem just a few months before the march and was heckled by protesters shouting, "We want Malcolm." When the NAACP held their conference in Chicago, they invite Mayor Daley to give introductory remarks, and he is heckled from the floor. When their leaders go to speak to Kennedy about holding the march, Kennedy says to them, "We have legislation, that's currently going through Congress. We would rather have new laws than have the Negroes out on the streets. And A. Philip Randolph, the socialist and trade union organizer who's primarily responsible for calling the march, tells Kennedy, the Negroes are already in the streets, Mr. President, and I doubt if you called them that they would come back. That is the mood of the moment, that the patience has worn out, the forbearance, the ability to withstand the clubs and the hoses that can fire so strong they can knock the bark off a tree at 30 feet being fired at children and dogs, has become too much. And so African Americans, who are always fighting back, start to resist like with like. In Birmingham, there is eventually they respond to the bombings of the Klan with violence. And there's a fear, both among the civil rights leadership and among the Kennedy administration, that black people will resist and will meet like with like. That is the mood that creates a necessity for a march, which is called at the beginning of the year, but very few people want. The polls show that most Americans don't want it, particularly most white Americans don't want it. Kennedy doesn't want it. It's insufficiently radical for many of the youth and too radical for many of the more conservative leadership. But by the time it happens, there is a sense that if they don't do this, then what are they going to do to channel this frustration, this mass frustration? And so the march happens. Now, the key fear, primarily of the state, is that there will be violence. This is peculiar because most of the violence in the South has come from the white segregationists, not from African Americans. But nonetheless, the fear is that there will be violence, and so it is literally policed as a military operation. It's called Operation Steep Hill. 82nd Airborne, ready to fly up from North Carolina at a moment's notice and drop 19,000 troops on D.C. 1,000 troops in D.C. Deployed, 6,000 police working, all leave cancelled, all elective surgery cancelled, baseball game cancelled, alcoholic sales are made illegal. And even on the mic that King speaks from, there is a kill switch that the Justice Department put in surreptitiously. The idea is that if anybody calls for insurrection from the stage, that they will flip the switch and play Mahalia Jackson singing, "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands." That's their response. And so it is into that atmosphere that King plans his address. Now, King gave around 350 speeches that year. So if you take time off for high days and holidays, that's about a speech a day. And generally, he's not giving a bespoke speech. He's an African-American Baptist preacher. And in that tradition, he drafts his sermon, but then he crafts it in response to how the audience is taking to what he's saying. And he has a number of arsenal, a series of weapons that he can use, rhetorical weapons. But the difference is that this speech, unlike other speeches, is going to be televised. If you're in the black church or the civil rights movement, you'd heard King speak before. But if you weren't, this was his oratorical introduction to the nation. Kennedy had never heard him give a speech before, and at the end of the speech, he turns to one of his aides in the Oval Office and says, "Damn, he's good." And so King and his team want something that is going to be on a par with Gettysburg. Now, we know a lot of these details because the FBI were kind enough to record them for us. He wants something on a par with Gettysburg, and so his... one of his main aides, Wyatt T. Walker, says to King, "Don't do the I Have a Dream thing. It's trite. It's a cliche. You've used it too many times before." And that's the first line of the book. And indeed, King had used it many times before. He first recorded using of it was in 62. It's thought that he probably used it in 61. That's a couple of years before. He'd used it in June at a rally in Detroit. And even a week earlier at a fundraiser for black insurance executives in Chicago. So this was not the first time that, by a long stretch, that he had used the I Have a Dream refrain. And King worries away at this speech. He seeks counsel. He has a lot of input, much more than he would generally. And what we know is that when he goes to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning of the march, I have a dream is not in the text of the speech that we know. And according to Clarence Jones, his lawyer and his speechwriter, it was not in King's mind to do that the next day. So the next day, there is a series of meetings they have with Congress. There's a funny kind of moment at the beginning of the day where they're in meeting Congress, and they come out, and the march has started without them, very symbolically, given what I've said earlier. Bayard Rustin, the out-gay, ex-communist, conscientious objector, and that's before you get to the fact that he's black. He's the organizer of this march, and he runs out of Congress, sees the march leaving, and says, we are supposed to be leading them. They jump into their limousines and try to catch up with the march, but are blocked by the traffic caused by the march that they themselves have called. And so they jump out of the limousines, and they run to catch up with the march. And if you look at pictures of the leaders of the march, in a kind of Fred Flintstone version of photoshopping, what they did was basically just clear people out of the way so it looks as though they are at the front of the march, but actually they're in the middle. And throughout that day, King is worrying away at this text, scrawling all over it. If you look at the actual, what he ends up with, you know, what's left on the podium when he finishes speaking, it's full of doodles and scrawls and so on.
You're listening to Gary Young, author of The Speech on Making Contact. Special thanks to The New School for use of the recording. To find out more about the show or to download past episodes, go to radioproject.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. Up next, Gary Young explains what had to happen to turn Martin Luther King Jr. from an unpopular figure at the time of his death to the widely praised icon we know today.
I can tell from your applause he needs no further introduction. Mr. Bob Dylan.
It was a hot day, 87 degrees at noon, and King is the 16th on a agenda of 80.
Oh, this time will come up when the wind.
He's a 10th speaker. There's been the anthem, the invocation, the prayer. There have been a range of a number of singers, including Mahalia Jackson, Peter, Paul and Mary, Bob Dylan. A range of people have sung. And he takes to the podium about 2:30.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
And according to Clarence Jones, who drafted much of the text, King keeps closer to this text than he would regularly keep.
I am happy to join with you today.
Those who wrote speeches for King said they were always King's speeches, basically, but you would be, in Clarence Jones's words, like a very crude architect. You would set up the four walls, and then King, like a beautiful interior designer, would come and he would make it his own. And King speaks very faithfully to the main text.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
But then and if you listen to the speech, and I would advise you to listen to it, it's the most popular, least well-known speech I've heard of. When I told my brother I was doing this book, he said, I love that speech. It's such a great speech. You know, that thing about I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land, and I said, it's a great speech, but it's not that speech. And he's winding up. He says, go back to Mississippi, go back to Louisiana, go back to South Carolina,
go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed.
Behind him is sitting Mahalia Jackson, a very, very close and special friend. When King was on the road, he would often call Mahalia Jackson for what they termed gospel therapy. He would call her and he would ask her to sing to him down the phone to soothe his spirit when he was down. And so he knew her well, he knew her voice well, and she shouts, "Tell him about the dream, man, tell him about the dream." She had heard him deliver the dream segment in June in Detroit. King continues.
Let us not wallow in the valley of despair.
And then she shouts again, "Tell us about the dream, Martin. Tell us about the dream."
I say to you today, my friend.
And then, in the words of Clarence Jones, King puts his text to the left of the podium. And in his body language, changes from a lecturer to a preacher. And Jones turns to the person next to him and says, "Those people don't know him, but they're about to go to church."
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
At which point, Wyatt T. Walker, the man who advised him not to do that, who's in the crowd, turns to the person next to him and says, "Oh, he's doing the dream." So that's how we got there. And what's interesting is that when you ask people who were there at the time and who knew King well, to a person, they will tell you that they did not, of all the speeches that he made, this was not particularly one that they thought we would be talking about in 50 years' time. It was a great speech, that none of them, you know, deny that. But many of them have different speeches that they thought were better, and either way, they said great speeches was what King did. And so I spend a fair amount of time in the book looking at why that is, and I want to kind of really suggest two things here. The first is that there is something for pretty much everybody in this speech. If you are an African American, part of a community who's told that you are genetically stupid, that you're poor because you're stupid, that your stupidity is your responsibility, and that your the failings in your community have nothing to do with history and everything to do with you, then to know that the best speech, America's favorite speech, was delivered by an African American in the black vernacular as an indictment of American racism is something to be very proud of. If you are a patriot, there is nothing in this speech that you need worry about.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Literally and metaphorically delivered in the shadow of Lincoln, that pays homage to the founding fathers, the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence. It's an American speech. Couldn't have come from anywhere else. If you are progressive, this speech comes on this day. There have been few days like this for American progressives. Fair enough, only 20% of the crowd was white, which was less than what they were expecting. But nonetheless, this was the first march of its kind in Washington. Now, marches in Washington are two to a penny, but this mass demonstration, they hoped for 100,000, they got 250,000. Had never been done before. And it comes, and this is the way I describe it in the book, it is the most eloquent articulation of the last great moral act that America can claim for which there is any consensus, and that is the end of American apartheid. That whatever people say now or feel able to say, nobody who wants to be taken seriously is calling for those signs to go back up. Nobody is calling for a return to formal, codified segregation. And however small that may seem when we see the amount of racism that can still spew from the mouths of those who are elected or unelected, that is no small thing. The end of apartheid is a big thing. And it's, I believe it's the last great moral thing that America can really claim to have done as a country. So there is that a number of people have something to claim, but there's also something else. King, when he delivers that speech, there is an even number of Americans with a favorable and unfavorable view of him. By 66, twice as many Americans have an unfavorable view than a favorable view. And then he's dead in 68, assassinated. By 1999, when Americans are polled on who are their favorite characters of the 20th century, King comes second only to Mother Teresa. So something happens between when he is assassinated as a somewhat marginal and polarized figure and 1999. And this is what I think has happened. First of all, why does he become unpopular? Well, when the speech is delivered, the year after comes the Civil Rights Act. The year after that comes the Voting Rights Act. Legislation begins to kick in, and King understands that the end of segregation is not the same as the beginning of equality. As he says, I have given people, we have won the right to eat in any restaurant of our choice, but we do not have the ability to eat everything that's on the menu because we can't afford it.
There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water?
Now, that kind of talk in America in 1967 will get you killed. And sure enough, a year later, he is killed. So he starts talking about capitalism. Year after that, in 67, he starts at the Riverside Church. He calls America
the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today
and takes a stand against the Vietnam War. Now, how is America then going to remember King? Well, it can't remember him if it's going to raise him to iconic status. If it's going to put him on the mall, then it has to sanitize him for public consumption. It has to make him the kind of person who could come second to Mother Teresa. And you can't do that with a man in America who questions capitalism. Because to remember King in that way would not raise him above the fray, it would enter him into it. You can't remember King as a man who criticized capitalism and still hold him up as an American icon. That doesn't work unless what it takes to be an American icon changes. You can't remember him, America can't remember him, the powers that be, as the man who called America the greatest purveyor of military violence in the world today, because arguably it still is. And it was notable on the 50th anniversary of the speech. It took place literally on a split screen. And on one screen, there was Obama, Clinton, Carter, carrying King's mantle, cloaking themselves in his legacy. And on the other screen, will we bomb Syria? When will we bomb Syria? Why wouldn't we bomb Syria? You can't remember King as that, have him on the mall, and still claim him to be an American icon when he's speaking about America being the greatest purveyor of military violence. But you can remember him as a man who got rid of American apartheid. Not American racism, because that would involve a whole different set of conversations about why black men in D.C. have a lower life expectancy rate than men on the Gaza Strip. You can't have that conversation, but you can have the conversation about why or how he got rid of American apartheid. And so that's the way that they choose to remember him. And so I end with just one paragraph where I talk about the process by which King, and through him the speech, can be sanitized. And I say, white America, most of it, came to embrace King in the same way that most white South Africans came to accept Nelson Mandela, grudgingly and gratefully. Retrospectively, selectively, without grace, but with considerable guile. By the time they realized their dislike of him was spent and futile, he'd created a world in which admiring him was in their own self-interest, because, in short, they had no choice. When it comes to King and his speech, one of the central arguments in this book is it's not just about what you remember, it's also about what you forget. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Gary Young, author of The Speech, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream, and the Story Behind It, published by Haymarket Books. Special thanks to the New School for use of their recording. To find out more about Making Contact, go to radioproject.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Quan Booth, Laura Flynn, Jasmine Lopez, Lisa Rudman, and Andrew Stelzer. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia in Portland. In 2018, the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal opened, the first tar sands by rail export terminal on the West Coast. The Center for a Sustainable Economy hosts this panel discussion with activists fighting tar sands by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia, 1106 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The New Year Dragon Dance Parade to celebrate the Year of the Rat begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and ends at the Oregon Historical Society. Live afternoon performances and activities will begin at 1:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.